This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on the show, we will discuss an incident this week that has caught a lot of attention regarding an LSU student accused of raping a woman after meeting her on the social media site Tinder. Rachel Hebert, the Executive Director of Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response, will comment on this and the problem with sexual assault on college campuses in particular. And is it safe to meet people on these social media sites? Also, Melody Moisey, her book is Howldall and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. Luke Nichter, Associate Professor of History at Texas A&M, also slated to be with us. He has produced a book along with Douglas Brinkley about the Nixon tapes. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. Rachel Hebert is our leadoff guest. She is executive director of the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Group here in Baton Rouge. And good morning to you, Rachel.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And it's appropriate to talk with you at this time because a story this week has been getting a great deal of attention. An LSU student, 22-year-old Jacob Witz, was arrested over the weekend after being accused of raping a woman he met using the dating app Tinder. Now, this arrest, of course, is something that will be litigated, and I'm sure Mr. Witz will get his day in court, so we give him the presumption of innocence. But rape is far too common, sexual assault is, on college campuses in particular. And these social media sites seem to be a cesspool for this kind of behavior. What's going on?
Well, Jim, what we're really seeing is that social media is now being used to actually blame, shame, and hold survivors accountable for rape instead of focusing attention on offenders. And really, these sites, of course, do not cause rape. Rapists cause rape. But what we're seeing is that it's being used more and more for predatory behavior.
Well, this site Tinder is noted as a site where people, quote, hook up. So with that as the backdrop, Mr. Witz apparently had a different kind of impression about this meeting than his victim did, if he is guilty. And if it's designed for people to meet and have sexual encounters, it would seem to be a case in which this might breed this sort of behavior.
Well, certainly could, absolutely. But we know that rape isn't the cause. Tinder doesn't cause rape. That people can hook up and people have basic human rights to decide who, when, and where to have sex with anyone. So
there's no excuse for this. And if the woman is Vice President Joe Biden said, if she says no at any time, that means no. And in this case, no occurred in her bedroom, according to the police report. But this Tinder site, is it something that is popular among college students?
Very popular. Many people are using Tinder. It's exclusively photo-driven, so you can actually swipe and see different people's photos. Not a lot of content, not a lot of biographical information. So it's sort of a snap decision on whether or not you want to communicate with someone. It's very common in the college community.
297-5633, your number for Rachel Hebert with the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Center here in Baton Rouge. She's been doing this for 7 years, and you have a background in this kind of unfortunate behavior. And in Baton Rouge, it being a college town, I would imagine that, unfortunately, there are many people who are, quote, victims of sexual assault.
Absolutely. The White House recently released a study that found that 1 in 5 women on college campuses are sexually assaulted. And what we know is that that number is alive and well in Baton Rouge, but it's so underreported. And a lot of times because victims come out and report and they get scrutinized in the court of public opinion on social media and likewise.
According to the latest statistics, nearly 90,000 people report being raped in the U.S. In the last year that is available. an arrest rate of only 25%, and of course a conviction rate much lower than that. So unfortunately, most people who do this sort of thing, quote, get away with it.
They do. And a lot of times survivors, when they see the community rallying around the offender, instead of supporting the survivor, they actually regret coming forward and reporting. And that just informs other survivors that they should keep quiet and continue to live in silence.
According to the National Crime Victimization Survey by the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 39,590 men claim to have been raped in the U.S. in the last year that was available for reporting, that being 2008, 164,240 women. So it's not just a case of women being the victims.
It is not. That's a great point to make. It's certainly an issue that affects both men and women, but we do know that women are affected more frequently than men.
And what can women do? For example, this woman who met this gentleman on Tinder, could this have been avoided in any way, or was it just one of those things that that unfortunately happens and we have to deal with?
You know, a lot of people want to talk about prevention tips, and there are certainly ways that people can reduce their risk for any type of crime. But at STAR, we really try to focus on the offender's behavior and talk about how people can identify and look at predatory behavior, have warning signs to not get themselves in that situation. And I'm speaking about the offender.
Not only rape, but physical assaults as well, which
Absolutely.
Are even more common. And yesterday, Frank DeFord of NPR had a commentary about the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, giving a slap on the wrist to Ray Rice, the Baltimore Ravens running back, two games for beating his girlfriend unconscious. And yet the same Roger Goodell suspended the Saints coach for a whole year for a bounty scandal that involved players hitting each other with pads on. It would seem that Goodell, if he's going to suspend Sean Payton for a year, he should have suspended Ray Rice for at least a year. And DeFord says this is cultural ignorance. Why would people not take into account the severity of an NFL running back beating up his girlfriend and knocking her unconscious?
That's a great question, Jim. A lot of people see these issues as domestic issues. They don't see it as a larger societal problem that, like we do at STAR. People think it's an issue between families, between couples, but really what we know is that this is violent, offensive behavior that needs to be stopped. And so when people like the commissioner come out and say, well, you're only going to be suspended for two games, it really shows the whole culture what we're really living in.
Well, Ray Rice ended up marrying the woman who was assaulted, and Rush Limbaugh yesterday in his program said, how bad could it have been if she married the guy? Well, quite often women do marry their abusers.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the thing to remember is that people love abusers. People love rapists. Rapists are people just like you and I. They're not the scary person hiding in the bushes. They're not some ugly-looking monster. They're people just like us.
297-5633. We'll take some calls for Rachel Hebert, who is with the Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response Group. That's STAR, the acronym. And you've been there for 7 years. The organization has been in existence for?
Since 1975.
1975, so almost 40 years. And on college campuses, to give an idea of what women primarily and some men are dealing with on campuses, 19% of the women who go to college claim they have been sexually assaulted, and 6% of the men. That's either rape or attempted rapes in the course of their college experience. And for most of us, our college years were the best years of our lives, but something like that, if it happens one time, I would imagine it it would ruin everything.
Absolutely. We see lots of effects, including decreased academic achievement, depression, anxiety, and survivors really unable to go on with their regular lives.
877-217-5757, wherever you may be. Rachel Hebert, our guest, Stephanie in South Downs. Hi, Stephanie. You're on WRKF.
Good morning. My heart breaks for the young woman, okay? It really does. And if the allegations are true, I'm sure this guy is a thug and deserves to be punished because there's no justification for rape. But what troubles me so much about this And please don't take this, Rachel, in the wrong spirit, but why is it, when are we going to teach young women that you don't pick up someone online and take them into your bedroom that you don't even know and make out with them and not be aware of the very real dangers and consequences of this? I mean, I have a real problem with that. And the fact that, yeah, I mean, she's an unfortunate victim, but she really set herself up for it. And I just don't see why we can't address that head on, because I really think that's important.
What do you think, Rachel?
Certainly. Thank you, Stephanie, for calling. And I think that's a lot of the public outreach is really focusing on the victim's actions and behaviors prior to the assault. And I hear you. But what we know is that rape isn't a punishment for poor judgment. And when the community focuses on responses like yours, Stephanie, it makes survivors think that they can't come forward. Now, of course, we do lots of training in the community about risk reduction, especially on college campuses. And what we know is that predators are everywhere, and it doesn't matter the situation that the victim is in prior to, that people are at risk at all times. For us women walking around, you're not supposed to go alone anywhere. You're not supposed to walk alone at night, anything, go to bars alone. So where does it stop? Where do we become safe in this community as women?
Would it have been better for the lady, the victim, to have met this guy at a public place rather than inviting him to her apartment?
You know, a lot of people have proposed that question, but what's to say that they would have met in a public place and then moved it to a private home and then the same thing happened?
But sometimes you can judge whether or not somebody is a whack job, and if this guy did what he's accused of doing, he's got a problem. And by the way, when he was 19 years old and a freshman, he was arrested for an incident involving his girlfriend, filing a false police report. So it appears that people like this usually have patterns of behavior.
They absolutely do, Jim. That's a great point. We usually see lots of warning signs along the continuum of sexual violence. So looking at peeping, stalking, cyber stalking, things like that, you can usually tell when someone's escalating. And I think this is the case with this perpetrator.
I recall it's been more than 20 years now, but when Mike Tyson went to prison for raping Miss Rhode Island Desiree Washington, the heavyweight champion of the world, he was defended by none other than Donald Trump, who said that the woman basically got what she deserved because she went to his hotel room at 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, what was she expecting? Well, Mr. Trump is, of course, dead wrong. Rape is rape, no matter what the circumstances. But there is a school of thought, and maybe people don't verbalize it as much anymore, but there is a school of thought that Trump is onto something, that just common sense would tell you that if you go to Mike Tyson's hotel room at 2 o'clock in the morning, he's not expecting to go up there for coffee and donuts.
Sure, Jim, and that's a great point. And there's a common misconception that it's a misunderstanding, that women are approaching men and wanting to have a conversation or make out and not have sex. But perhaps this victim, just like the victim in the Rhode Island case, did want to have consensual sex, but it turned violent. And as we know, anytime you say no, it's rape.
Ben and Hammond. Ben, good morning. You're on the air with Rachel Hebert of Star. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. I had a question for Miss Rachel.
Yes.
And my question is my comment first is that I saw a letter to the editor that may be attributed to the accused, which indicated a high level of misogyny. I'm wondering what the rate of misogyny is with rapists.
What about men's attitudes toward women? Rapists, I would think, have some issues there as well.
Certainly. So a lot of what we would call misogynistic viewpoints, or viewpoints that women are not at the same class or standard as men, certainly contribute to a rape culture. So a culture where we condone and normalize rape is certainly something that we're living in here in Baton Rouge.
Well, the behavior sometimes is undetectable. Darren Sharper, the former Saint who helped the Saints win the Super Bowl, posed with his teenage daughter and also appeared in a book called NFL Dads, dedicated to daughters, discussing his devotion to women. He says, "My daughter makes me mindful of how women are treated, undervalued, and exploited. He instructed men to deal with women respectfully, honorably, and fairly at all times." Now Mr. Sharper is accused of raping women in 5 states. 297-5633 is your number. Back in 90 seconds with Rachel Hebert. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Rachel Hebert is our guest for a bit longer. She is the executive director of STAR, Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response, here in Baton Rouge. And this is a pertinent topic at any time, but especially at this time. As a young man under arrest for allegedly sexually assaulting, raping a woman he met on the social media site Tinder, meeting her at her apartment, they retired to her bedroom, and the young lady says she declined his offer for sexual activity, but he raped her, according to her, and now this young man is facing some serious charges. And this Tinder site is under review because it is, quote, a place where some people meet to hook up, and it is certainly a prescription for disaster in some cases, it would seem. Now, people are adults. They know what they're getting into most of the time. Should they have the right to endanger themselves in cases like this? Should that be a First Amendment right, if you will, Rachel?
Well, I would challenge that to say that I don't know that everyone thinks that it's a danger to meet people online. I think certainly it certainly has risks not meeting people in person first, but I would say that everyone has the basic human right to decide when, where, and with whom to have sex.
Well, it's a case in which no always means no, but in some cases it's more difficult to get help, and in this case, if the woman was alone in her apartment with this guy, and he came there with the intention of having a, quote, hookup, it would seem that she was putting herself in a bad situation.
Sure, but if you look at the circumstances around the sexual assault that actually occurred, him having her delete the text messages, him watching her shower to make sure that there was no DNA, I mean, these are clearly predatory behaviors. This isn't just a hookup gone bad.
What about the crime? We talked about 90,000 people report being raped. That's only those who report being raped. Obviously, many others are raped and don't report it. And then there's an arrest rate of only 25% and a conviction rate that's much lower than that. This is something that that people may think they can do without impunity. It is a serious situation.
Definitely. When we don't hold offenders accountable, women are not going to come forward, men are not going to come forward and say that they were raped. When our community doesn't promptly respond by arresting, and when the community comes out and actually challenges the victim, what we see is that people are less likely to come forward.
So if a young person or an old person asks you if they should make themselves available for meeting people on one of these social media sites, what do you tell them, Rachel?
Well, I certainly believe that everyone should be very vigilant with their personal safety. And of course, I would inform people of the ways to reduce their risk. But I would also say that, you know, it's your life and you should live your life the way you feel comfortable.
Now, there is a story today in the Baton Rouge Advocate about a man accused of a double rape, and he has confessed to one of them, another 22-year-old young man, accused of raping two women that he allegedly picked up a year apart in the Tigerland area. And he would, in this case, go after women who were on foot. Is it a good thing to be walking at certain times of the night in certain places without some sort of escort?
Certainly. I mean, I think that's one of the victim-blaming attitudes that we have, looking at the victim's behavior again and not challenging what the perpetrator is doing, looking for women, picking up women that are vulnerable.
Well, sometimes men say that women incite bad behavior by the way they're dressed. That should have nothing to do with it either.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And I would think that if a person is intent on raping another person, dress or lack thereof has very little to do with it. It's more about power than sex.
Definitely. It's about power, control, and humiliation.
297-5633, your number. Rachel Hebert with us, and Travis on I-10. Hi, Travis. Good morning. You're on the air with Rachel.
Hi, Jim. Thanks. I get aggravated when I hear people questioning, you know, what the decisions that people make. You know, where are you going to meet? Should you invite someone over to your house? It just sounds like the Taliban in Afghanistan. Women can't go any place by themselves. Women have to have you know, a male relative with them to protect them at all times. You know, instead of treating women like you're making the mistake, I don't know why, as a society, we can't put the blame where it belongs on the criminals who do not respect other people's personal bodies, space, liberty. You know, as a man, I can stop anytime I want to. And anybody who is a normal, healthy human being has that ability. If you don't, there's either something wrong with you or you're a criminal. Put these people away and stop acting like a woman who decides at any point during the process that she doesn't want to have sex is at all culpable in the process.
Travis, what do you think the penalty should be for rape?
Well, you need to go to jail, certainly. I don't know how to fix it. I don't know what's wrong with people that they make these decisions. So I don't know if there's rehabilitation involved. But at the very least, we need to make them miserable so maybe they'll not do it again. Or at least while they're locked
up. How about
up,
capital punishment? How about the death penalty?
I don't think so. Because I don't know what the solution is, but I definitely think that we should at least get them off the streets for a while and work on figuring out what's wrong with people. Because it's the rapist that's the problem, not the victim.
Castration?
I don't know. I don't know why they do it. And maybe if
well,
we
if they're
knew
castrated, they don't have the means to do it. At least not the means that most cases involve.
You know, in certain circumstances, I might be okay with that.
Okay. Thank you, Travis. Appreciate it. 297-5633 in our remaining moments with Rachel Hebert of Star. Now, of the people who see you, is it usually a case of sexual assault?
Absolutely, Jim. We see lots of sexual assault. We see rape, attempted rape, sexual harassment. We actually serve anyone that's experienced sexual trauma. And I do want to thank Travis for his comments. We certainly need more people like Travis in the community.
Well, Olivia writes, this alleged rapist did not just exist on Tinder. He was a student on LSU's campus. He could have just as easily been in a class with her and offered to come over and study. It doesn't matter how he got there, but that when she said no, he didn't listen. In fact, most survivors of sexual assault are assaulted by people they know that they trust to be in their homes.
Absolutely. More than two-thirds of victims know their perpetrator.
More than two-thirds.
More than two-thirds. It's happening in families and marriages and dating relationships as well as friend relationships.
Women, I think, understandably have some issues about bringing this to the public domain. For example, this lady who was an alleged victim, if she wants to see this man go to jail, she'll have to probably take the stand and tell the world what happened. How difficult is that?
It's incredibly difficult. It takes a lot of courage for someone to actually come forward and report to police, deal with the public scrutiny, deal with feeling stigmatized as a victim.
Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on with Rachel.
Good morning, Jim, and good morning, Rachel. Let me say that as a brother to three sisters and a father to two daughters, this speaks volumes to me about something that no one seems to want to acknowledge, and that is we live in a very over-sexualized, male-dominated society, and it's not just in the U.S. I mean, it hasn't been covered here, but there have been vicious rapes in India. There have been scandals with media figures in the U.K., so this is a global phenomenon. But what no one is talking about is our failure to educate our young men and women on how to appropriately address their sexuality. And this is creating these crises in our communities, in our schools, and on university campuses, in workplaces. And here in Louisiana, like an ostrich, the head is still in the sand when it comes to sexual education. So I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about that. Thank you.
Rachel?
That's a great point. Thank you for bringing up healthy masculinity and healthy sexuality, which we aren't able to teach in schools or in anything because it has to deal with sex. But I think you make a great point that this is really something we need to be educating young people, both boys and girls, about.
And a listener asks about public officials and their commitment to this cause, and I think I know where the person is going, but let's say a public official has engaged in consorting with prostitutes. Does that make him more or less likely to be sensitive to the concerns of women about sexual assault?
Well, I certainly think it contributes to our culture that objectifies women, over-sexualizes women, and points to those misogynistic behaviors we were talking about previously.
So should that be a determining factor when we cast votes about people?
I don't know that I'd say that. I mean, everyone's entitled to do whatever they feel is right, but I would say that it's a warning sign.
A warning sign. Is there any way to determine, Rachel, people who are more or less likely to be participants in this kind of behavior?
There are. There's expressed lack of empathy, antisocial behavior, lack of care for someone's boundaries, especially sexual boundaries.
Well, for those who'd like more information about STAR, Sexual Trauma and Awareness and Response in this area, how would they find you and the people who work with you?
We have a hotline number, 225-383-RAPE. We also have a website, brstar.org.
Thank you very much.
Thank
appreciate you,
Jim.
You coming in. It's a sensitive topic, but one that is worthy of discussion. And I'm sure, unfortunately, we'll have occasion to talk about this again. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest now is Luke Nichter, Associate Professor of History at Texas A&M and a noted expert on the Nixon tape. He is the author of the book just out, Richard Nixon and Europe. Actually, that one's coming soon. But his latest, co-authored with Douglas Brinkley, is The Nixon Tapes, 1971-1972. Good morning, Luke.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And please tell me if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, your last name.
Yeah, Nichter, that's right.
I got you. Okay. Well, between February 1971 and July of 1973, President Nixon secretly recorded 3,700 hours of phone calls, 3,700 hours before resigning in disgrace on August 9, 1974. In a few days, it will be, 40 years since Richard Milhouse Nixon went off to California and called it a career in politics. But what do those tapes reveal? Are they still full of all kinds of revelations that are surprising and revealing after all these years?
Yeah, I think there are still a lot of revelations. So the tapes were recorded from 71, 72, and 73. And, you know, we've all heard a lot about Watergate over the years, and Watergate is a big enough subject on its own that we want to work now on a separate book about that. But what you have in this book is kind of before the crisis, before the investigation is taking place into the White House. And what you see in the book is the subjects that Nixon himself spent most of his time on each day, getting us out of Vietnam, the opening in relations to China, negotiating with the Russians, and of course, plenty of politics, plenty of gossip. You're a fly on the Oval Office, and you see kind of day by day the policymaking process in real time.
Well, 1971 to 73, and this was a year before Nixon resigned. 3,700 hours of tapes. That's 154 days, 154 24-hour days. How does anybody have the ability to listen to these and think, well, that's something that people will be interested in? After a while, I bet you get dizzy listening to this stuff.
It's true, but the President of the United States, whether it's then or now, does a lot of interesting things and meets a lot of interesting people. You know, whether it's Elvis Presley, whether it's foreign leaders, whether it's Hollywood and athletes, there's a lot on these tapes. And it's been my pleasure to work on these because almost every day you hear something that it's really new. You learn something, and some days you hear things that are very shocking. And of the 3,700 hours total recorded, there are still 700 or 800 hours that have not yet been released by the National Archives. So I think we're going to continue to learn new things for still many more years.
The guest is Luke Nichter, a professor of history at Texas A&M, and he has co-authored with Douglas Brinkley, who for many years was at UNO, The Nixon Tapes, 1971-1972. And Richard Nixon, he thought he was doing something for the history books that would enhance his legacy, and my goodness, he did just the opposite.
Well, it certainly has been for the history books, but not the way that he intended. And most of his aides during Watergate advised him to burn the tapes, that if you want to save your presidency, you better destroy these recordings. And at the time, it would have been terrible public relations for his presidency, but legally he could have done that. But Richard Nixon, right or wrong, I think he took a gamble with history. He knows better than anyone the damaging material on the tapes about Watergate and other abuses of power, but he took a gamble that it might take 20 years, 50 years, maybe even 100 years, that achievements in other areas, such as the opening in relations with China, would outlast his critics. And so we'll see.
Well, you're getting some interesting plaudits from this. Gordon Liddy says, "You have my complete support and confidence." And here's a man who is complicit in this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I started working, I was a student in grad school when I started working on these, and once I started to listen to these, words somehow got out. It wasn't me. And many people who were recorded on the taping systems, would say John Kerry, Joe Biden, I mean, figures even in politics today were young then, early in their political careers. They were interested in two things as they're writing their memoirs, as they're later in life and their careers. Could I have a complete copy of what I said to the president so I remember? No. But some of them, like George H.W. Bush said, I'd also like to know what he said about me after I left the room, since the recording system was still running. So, you know, this has been a lot of fun in addition to a lot of hard work.
Nixon famously said, "I'm not a crook." As it turned out, was he a crook?
Well, the verdict of history certainly is that he was a crook and that there are many documented abuses of power. This is not a book that's meant to be for Nixon or against Nixon. This is unedited. This is unvarnished, unfiltered. You have it, the reader has it the way it happened. And I say, like any political leader, there's good and there's bad. Give Nixon credit where credit is due, and let's be critical of areas that deserve criticism.
He was a man who came out of nowhere. He was a poor boy from Yorba Linda, California, and born in 1913, and rose to the vice presidency at the age of 39, was counted out, and then won the presidency in 1968. Why did he not realize what he had? What was it in his inner being that caused him to be so sinister?
It's hard to say, and that's complicated, and some of that, as a historian, I'll leave for the psychologist and the psychiatrist, I think. But there's something, you know, Nixon was someone who kind of grew up, Chuck Colson told me one time, you know, the reason why Nixon and I got along so well was we were from the same school of politics. He called it the Neum in the Groin School of Politics. And this is a hardscrabble guy. I mean, he grew up, they were poor in California. They lived in a desert-like climate. The Lemon Ranch failed. Nixon never had much. He, just Richard Nixon, he occupies a unique place in American political history.
You're fading on us, but it is a good read. The Nixon Tapes, Luke Nichter and Douglas Brinkley. Thank you so much for joining us today, Luke. And we shall return in 90 seconds on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Frank Barnett is producing. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org, and you may tweet us at Jim Inkster Show. And today has been an interesting day, and we're slated to be joined in a few moments by Melody Moisey, born to Persian parents at the height of the Islamic Revolution and raised amid a vibrant, loving, and gossiping Iranian diaspora in the American heartland. And we will talk with her, if everything goes according to form, about her book, Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. Melody's contention is that people live with mental illness and quite often are stigmatized in ways that other people with physical illnesses are not. Today, Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden wrote an editorial to the Baton Rouge Advocate that appears, and in it he criticizes Governor Jindal on Common Core, and I'm sure we will be discussing this in the days to come. But it is interesting now that the governor and the lieutenant governor, who've never really been on the same page, they are now officially divorced as far as opinions regarding Common Core. And I think with Darden running for governor, we'll see more of this in the coming year. 2975633 is your number. Good morning, Melody Moisey. Nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me.
Melody, by the way, has been a contributor to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Guardian, and to NPR. And you have written a compelling book about mental illness. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution says, blistering, brash, and irreverent for the many who struggle to make sense of and survive this misunderstood disorder. Now, when did you realize that you were afflicted with bipolar disease?
I wasn't properly diagnosed until I was 29 years old, and for many people, that's the case that they're misdiagnosed for a long time, and for me, it took 10 years to get a proper diagnosis. I was misdiagnosed with unipolar depression, and unfortunately, if you medicate unipolar depression the way that most people do with antidepressants, you can exacerbate bipolar disorder, so it's very important that people get the correct diagnosis up front and take second, third, fourth, fifth opinions if they can.
As far as people in the United States, we live in a stress-filled world. Is this more and more prevalent?
Yeah, it's prevalent in the U.S. about 2-4%, depending on who you ask. And then the spectrum of bipolar disorder seems widening. I think there's an overdiagnosis of children, and in general, just diagnosing childhood as mental illness when it may not be. Not to say that there isn't pediatric bipolar disorder, there is for sure, but it seems like it's being overdiagnosed in a lot of cases. But it's not just in the United States. 4 of the top 10 leading causes of disability around the world are mental illnesses, and sometimes we view them as being just first world problems, but they're not. They affect people all over the world.
Now, if we have cancer or arthritis or heart disease or some physical malady, we're usually not reluctant to tell people about it. But why are we reluctant to discuss bipolar disorder and other mental illnesses?
I think part of it has to do with people thinking that it's the person's fault, that it's some sort of moral failing, that it's a sign of weakness. And, you know, there was a time where talking about cancer even was stigmatized. So my hope is that it is moving towards that direction of being people being more comfortable talking about it. The reason it's so important is because our silence in these cases can be deadly. People will not seek help because of the stigma, no matter even if they have the funds and the access and all of that. Just because of the stigma, they won't seek help. And up to 20% of people with bipolar disorders take their own lives. These are really dangerous illnesses if they're not treated.
Well, you note, Melody, that when you were battling severe physical illness at the age of 18, your friends and the community filled your hospital room with roses and lilies and hyacinths. But when you attempted suicide and you were diagnosed with bipolar disorder, there were no flowers.
Yeah. And that's what happens. I think it's just the silence surrounding it. And I come from a medical family. Both my parents are physicians. My sister is a doctor. My best friend happens to be a psychiatrist. So there's a lot of doctors in my family and around me growing up. I grew up in an Iranian diaspora in Dayton, Ohio, and there were a lot of doctors as well. But being in the medical community doesn't mean that you're not subject to that stigma as well. And within different minority communities like my own, then it can be even higher sometimes. And the fear of being judged and shamed in that smaller community is very high. So I think my family was trying to protect me and telling me to be quiet about it, but I've been an activist since I was a kid pretty much, and I've learned over the years that when people tell you to be quiet about something, often it's because you have something important to say.
2975633, if you'd like to engage Melody Moisey, an Iranian-American Muslim activist, attorney, writer, and now award-winning author. Her latest work is Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. Now, you're brilliant and beautiful and talented. Why did you try to commit suicide?
I don't think there's a really good answer for that. For me, it was and I say I attempted suicide my last year in law school, and it sort of tells you how irrational and thought and idea that is, given if you're born to commit suicide in law school, you ought to do it the first year, not the last. So it's irrational. It's not something that it's not like euthanasia, which is, you know, a rational choice, but it was something that my mind was tricking me. And I felt like it had been taken over and it didn't belong to me anymore. And that was painful.
Was it a close call?
It wasn't. I thankfully I got to the hospital and I was hospitalized pretty quickly thereafter. It was, for me, my manic stage was far more dangerous, because I thought I could do things I couldn't. I wasn't actively trying to kill myself, but I thought I could fly, for example. So it was good that I was also hospitalized when I finally experienced my acute manic episode, because I would have accidentally killed myself.
You thought you could fly. How long does this manic phase last, or did it last for you?
It depends. And, I mean, that's partly the name of the book, Haldol and Hyacinth. The Haldol is that first drug. It's an antipsychotic, and it brought me back to reality. And for me, I'm Muslim. I don't even drink alcohol, you know, so to have a mind that delusional, and I was having hallucinations and things like that, it was very strange and something I wasn't accustomed to. And thankfully, my family was able to recognize what it was quickly enough to get me to the hospital before I caused myself any damage. But had they not, I'm not sure what would have happened. It wouldn't have been good.
And then after the manic phase ends, the crash comes, doesn't it?
For a lot of people, and a lot of times, that's what happens. For me, the acute manic episode came immediately after a really dark, depressive period, and I had what they call a switch. Sort of one day I was extremely depressed, couldn't get out of bed, and the next day I was manic. There was nothing that really induced that. So that was sort of my family at the time. My husband was sort of happy to see me out of that. But then I just started going higher and higher, and I stopped sleeping, and I wasn't eating, and it became clear that this was something dangerous.
Well, you got help, and you're now taking Haldol. Anything else?
I'm not taking Haldol every day. Haldol is something, I actually don't take it anymore, but I do take an antipsychotic a few times a year. Most people who take Haldol every day, those are people with schizophrenia, or schizoaffective disorder, which is sort of in between bipolar and schizophrenia. It's not something a lot of people with bipolar would take every day. But I do take an antipsychotic when I feel a manic episode coming on, and at times I've been on mood stabilizers as well, which are the same as anticonvulsant drugs that people take for epilepsy. And those are used to stabilize moods in bipolar. But for everyone, it's different. Unfortunately, it's not like diabetes in the way that there's one drug that is going to work for everybody. And I really caution people to be cautious about taking medication when they're first prescribed. They should only be prescribed one medication at a time. You should go slowly if you're taking a medication every day. And you should communicate with your doctor and create a partnership. And instead of going off your meds because you don't like the side effects, tell your doctor you want to go off of these meds, they're not working for you, because there are other options. You don't need to just go off of them irresponsibly. There's a way to do it responsibly, and I think a lot of times people talk about patients being non-compliant and they stop taking their meds. There may be a good reason they stop taking their meds, and there may be a responsible way to do it by forming a partnership with their physician so that they can go off their meds and see what happens in a way that's responsible, and if they can find another med that possibly works better.
You say you take Haldol, Melody, when you feel one of these episodes coming on, but how do you know? What's the telltale sign?
For a lot of people, family members will know before they know, and sometimes my husband will catch it early. For me, I'm sort of lucky and cursed at the same time, because I have hallucinations and visual hallucinations, which are pretty rare with bipolar, and I have them early on. And I know within the first 24 hours that they are hallucinations. So there's that. Also, sleep is a big indicator for me. If I lose my appetite and also stop sleeping, those are two things.
So you're in good shape because you can tell that it's coming on. But I've seen people who get off their meds, and it's not a pretty sight. They go into one of these high periods, and they think they're invincible. They think they can jump from buildings or fly. And
exactly.
When somebody is in that kind of condition, what do you do at that point?
At that point, you have to get to the hospital, and then you have to get them an antipsychotic, most likely. But if you're able to catch it early on, and if you're able to manage it, then you can take that antipsychotic as needed. But for a lot of people, you need to take a mood stabilizer every day. It's just a matter of finding the one that works best for you, that you're able to tolerate the side effects. And there are newer ones that work really well. It's just a matter of, at the beginning, it's kind of tough for people trying to find the perfect medication. And people, I think, sometimes will give up too early and just say, I'm not going to take anything, not realizing that there could be something out there that could work really well for them. And for me, there was.
Things happening in the world trigger these kinds of episodes, or things happening in one's life? Is there some triggering mechanism?
It can exacerbate it, and sometimes it can come out of nowhere, and sometimes it can be triggered. And it's important to know what those triggers are. For me, and as an activist, the political events can have an effect on me, a real, you know, personal effect. And it varies by person, but that regulating sleep and diet, exercise, those kinds of things are just as important as medication in terms of controlling the illness.
Well, you're an Iranian-American Muslim activist, an attorney, a writer, and you live in Raleigh, North Carolina. Some would say that's kind of an unusual place. It's, of course, a great educational community, but you've chosen to live in the South. Why so?
I love the South. I've lived here for over 10 years. I lived in Atlanta before coming to Raleigh. I appreciate that, and it's very similar to my Persian culture and background. I think people up north like to talk a lot about how the South is racist, and for sure we're racist, but they're in a lot of ways just as racist as we are, but they're more subtle about it. And I prefer the racism to be in your face. Like, I would like to know somebody who's racist right away. And in the South, that's sort of possible. Up north, sometimes that's not as much. But joking aside, I mean, I just love living here. I love the environment, and I love the people. And in North Carolina right now, I mean, there's a lot of political battles to be had, but it's an amazing state, and there are amazing people here, and I'm happy here.
Well, you write about some of your tours promoting your writing, and including one in Little Rock. How did that go?
It went great. I went to get the Clinton Library in Little Rock, and that was actually shortly before, thankfully it wasn't in the midst of a manic episode, but it was shortly before I came back to Atlanta and had a manic episode later on. That experience went really well, and I've been really blessed in the South in general and embraced by different Southern writers. I spoke at the Southern Women's Writers Conference a couple years ago, and I remember being invited, and I was like, really, do I count as a Southern woman writer? And I think I do now, and I appreciate it, and I think the South isn't so black and white anymore. There are a lot of people moving in. We're becoming a lot more brown and yellow and different colors, and the rest of the South is going to have to get used to it, because I'm not going anywhere. I'm comfortable here, and I love it.
The book is Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life, from Melody Moisey. When you were in full bloom with these manic episodes, how often did they come, Melody?
I had what they call hypomanic episodes, which are more mildly manic episodes, and they came there was no regular pattern to them, but I experienced probably three or four mildly manic episodes before the acute manic episode. And that's why it's sort of important to try and catch this early on, because if I were able to catch it before the acute manic episode, before I had hallucinations and delusions, I may have been able to prevent that indefinitely. But unfortunately, because of the misdiagnosis, I wasn't able to do that. And now that my brain has gone to that place of delusions and hallucinations, it's just easier to go back. There's sort of no rewind with a lot of these serious mental illnesses, or at least not yet.
All right. A question before we go from a listener. Yeah. Mental illness of this kind, is it hereditary?
Yeah, parts of it are. If you take two twins, monozygotic twins, there's about a 60 to 70% chance if one has it that the other one will have bipolar disorder, whereas in the general population, it's about a 2 to 4% chance. So, yeah, highly heritable.
You've had quite a life and more life to come, and you have some perspective. Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life from Melody Moisey. Thank you for joining us today, Melody.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care and good luck. Let's talk again.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we shall return tomorrow. For Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Inkster. We thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.